Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about the career of actor Sidney Poitier. A really interesting career trajectory from a guy who actually is a citizen of the Bahamas. That's actually where his family is from, but was born in Florida because they went to pick up some supplies, and you know, he was born 2 months premature, which is why he is technically also an American citizen.
The Bahamas connection is important because when you think about the tonal qualities he has, think about that speaking voice. I mean, that lilt, if you will, it's very much, you know, British inflected, and you can see that heritage in what, you know, for the most part, we'd say is a very American actor, right? And yet the voice itself, in many ways, gives a sense of what his origins were.
One of the interesting things about him being, you know, from the Bahamas, really, is that he's a British citizen. And I think he has that sort of British elegance that I think of, you know, present day, like Idris Elba, that no matter what kind of role he plays, he always sort of embodies this very elegant man.
He really does. I actually met Sidney Poitier in 1995 when he received the Kennedy Center Honors in Washington. And the word that occurred to me immediately was dignity. There was a kind of elegance, a kind of dignity, something innate, if you will. And so, again, doubling back on that Bahamian background in the speaking voice and in, you know, the ethnic origins, if you will, that sense of him as being British as much as anything there, but very much an American actor, certainly, as his career gets underway.
Well, he started off with, you know, humble beginnings because his parents, you know, weren't wealthy by any means. And he had said in a book that he wrote called The Measure of a Man, he says when he went back to the Bahamas after having, you know, done some work in New York, in spite of the fact that he was really happy to see his parents again after 8 years, he says he had changed irrevocably. He stayed in a hotel. He didn't want to use the outhouse with its brown paper bag or green leaf toilet paper. He didn't want to carry water a quarter mile to have a wash up. Didn't want to have to build a fire to heat the water before he could take a bath. Wanted to turn a faucet and have limitless hot water, flip a switch and have light. You know, these are all things we just sort of take for granted, but that, you know, those deprivations were just simply normal when he was growing up.
Well, again, that's something quite common in that era that, you know, when we look at his biography, we think, you know, what hardship, what privation. And yet so many people in his generation, that's how he grew up, right? I mean, that was quote unquote normal, if you will. For us looking back, we think it was, you know, remarkable hardship. And yet, as he was living through that, that was just simply the community he lived in and how he lived. But I think for sure that had to have affected his development in terms of social awareness, social conscience, a kind of progressive attitude. And we'll talk more about that progressive attitude that, you know, when you've known privation, when you've known want like that, it's got to have some impact on you later on when you think about the people around you and in a racial and just in a socioeconomic way, who has and who doesn't have. I mean, that sense of a quest for social justice, if you will.
And that fight to constantly be proving yourself as being worthy or, you know, a spokesperson. There's a lot of baggage that comes with that. But let's jump right into the movie, starting with 1950's No Way Out, where he plays a Black doctor in a prison having to fight with a patient who is extremely bigoted. And this is sort of, you know, one of the themes that he keeps having to come, you know, deal with, which is, yes, I'm really a doctor. You know, he would move on to, yes, I'm really a teacher. And yes, I'm really a policeman in other movies. But in this one, you know, he's constantly having to justify himself to people who are just ignorant.
Well, yes, because race is always an issue here, always a consideration. You have to prove yourself. It's not enough to be good, you have to be really excellent, you know what I mean? To the point where people have to acknowledge that, yes, you really are a doctor. Yes, you're a teacher. Yes, you're a policeman. And that's a burden on the shoulders, if you will. And, you know, for all the elegance and dignity I talked about, that's part of his response to that, to prove himself. And for actors of his generation, they did have to prove themselves that way. And it's significant to note quickly, at least, that before he got into the movies, he was active in the theater, specifically the American Negro Theater. He was of that generation with Ruby Dee, Ossie Davis, a number of Black actors who began working with Black theater companies in the 1940s, typically, and then eventually segued by the later 40s to working on Broadway. In other words, we're talking about a breakthrough generation of Black actors who initially come along through theater. It's one reason why he became a friend of Paul Robeson's. They had theater connections that way. So by the late 40s, he's got theater experience, and he, along with the other actors I mentioned, are primed to break barriers in another sense. Having broken barriers in terms of New York theater specifically, he's now primed to go that next step, as they were, and to start making movies. Because indeed, his Broadway debut was in 1946 in an all-Black production of Lysistrata. So you can see the groundwork that's being laid there for roles like what you were just describing so well with No Way Out. He's not coming out of nowhere. He's got training on the stage, and he's very keenly aware of the fact that he has to prove himself. And to put it bluntly, to white audiences, by the time you're playing on Broadway or in Hollywood movies, right, you have to show that you've got what it takes, and you have more than what it takes. It's what you mentioned earlier. You have to really have what it takes.
And you have to prove yourself by embodying the role as if you were someone who, you know, in that case, in the movie No Way Out, as if you were a doctor, as if you had, you know, clawed your way through all of the barriers to get to that point. And then, you know, he's very believable as a doctor. In fact, it's an amazing breakout role because he seems so accomplished as an actor, you know, from his very first screen appearance.
See, that's why I wanted to mention the theater background. Even though it's his movie debut and a really quite remarkable debut performance, he wasn't an unknown. He had that theater training, and he had always had that voice. I keep coming back to that voice. When you hear that voice, it's mesmerizing, isn't it? The look and quality, the dignity, the confidence, all that. And those are qualities you need to make it, you know, in an otherwise oftentimes hostile environment. We talk about films in terms of cultural context, the society in which it was made, the forces against which Sidney Poitier and others were contending. In that respect, by way of genre, if you will, No Way Out's an example of what was oftentimes referred to as a problem picture. By problem picture, I don't mean there's something wrong with the picture itself. I mean that it's addressing social problems. Go back 3 years earlier, you have Gregory Peck and Gentleman's Agreement dealing with anti-Semitism. You have a number of films actually in the late 40s, like Pinky and so on, dealing with racial discrimination. That rolls over into the early 50s. And so oftentimes in the 50s, you'll have pictures that deal overtly with race relations, like The Defiant Ones, which we can talk about in a bit, or Blackboard Jungle, which is not specifically about race per se, more about juvenile delinquency, which was an obsession in the 50s. These are all examples of what were called problem pictures. Some of them produced and or directed by Stanley Kramer, but other directors as well. And even though we tend to think about Hollywood films in terms of escapism, you know, in the 50s, you know, fluffy escapist films, that's not entirely the case. There were films that directly, very bluntly, hit on social issues. And part of the breakthrough for Poitier was racial, to be the first Black movie star, to put it very bluntly. But then secondly, the kinds of roles he played, beginning, as you said so well, with No Way Out.
Now, I have not had a chance to see The Defiant Ones, so I'm going to let you discuss that one, and then we'll go on to Blackbird Jungle.
Okay, The Defiant Ones is made in 1958, and in that film, Sidney Poitier co-stars with Tony Curtis. It's literally putting the racial divide, the racial conflict, quite bluntly in Black and white terms. In other words, you have a Black convict and a white convict, and they've escaped, but they're handcuffed together. It's not a subtle film, I'll say that for it. It's extremely well-intentioned, but it, you know, the overt quality of the scripting there's no missing thematically what the points are. But the film itself got a lot of attention because here was an issue where Black and white are literally handcuffed together. What are they gonna do? They're both outsiders, if you will, both convicts, right? But what bonds them together are the handcuffs, and in the sense that there's a shared plight, a shared experience, and they need to somehow work together. So whatever racial animosity they may have towards each other has got to be worked out. And so think about that as a film that comes out just as the civil rights movement is really starting to gain some traction and certainly a lot of media attention. In a commercial sense, it was a very successful film, commercially and critically, and it really kind of dovetailed quite neatly with what was going on the front page of the newspaper.
Well, it's definitely one that I was looking to find. It's a little hard to find. It's not available unless you're going to buy the DVD for anybody out there who wants to try to find it. Let's talk a little bit about Blackboard Jungle for a minute, which is 1955, which would have been earlier. And what's interesting is it comes 5 years after No Way Out, where he plays, you know, a completely full-grown man and a doctor. Blackboard Jungle, he plays a student. And it's important to understand that at the time that they made this movie in 54, it was the year of Brown versus Board of Education. But even with that court decision notwithstanding, Black schools at that time were invisible to white America. What's fun about the movie is all the rock and roll music that's in there, which probably would have seemed really kind of controversial and, you know, moving the needle more towards what kids would want to watch, what kids would want to see.
Well, in fact, Blackboard Jungle, which was released in 1955, is notable for a few things. One is it's considered the first Hollywood movie to make use of rock and roll on the soundtrack, specifically Bill Haley and the Comets. And it's in the opening credits, and it's going for the youth market, as people would sometimes call it. You know, demographically, rock and roll is here to stay, right? And so Bill Haley and the Comets were such an important part of the early history of rock and roll. The school itself, now bear in mind, the film was shot in the studio, but it's set in New York. It's a real ethnic smorgasbord. There are Black students, also white students, Latino students. It's a real urban mix that way, if you will. Poitier, frankly, is a bit on the old side. He's into his 20s, but he's very convincing playing this high school student. And it's a really terrific performance. And again, the film, yet again, thematically deals with, you know, trying to get along. There are a lot of juvenile delinquents in this school. And the teacher, played by Glenn Ford, has to try to keep everyone, you know, in line, more or less, keep discipline in the classroom. What's striking, among other things, is the fact that the 1950s, believe it or not, was obsessed with juvenile delinquency. We tend to think of it as this happy-go-lucky, you know, white picket fence, you know, Ozzie and Harriet kind of world. And yet, go back, there were congressional hearings about juvenile delinquency. And everything from communism to comic books was being blamed for the kids of that day acting out. Again, this film in its own way, it's kind of creaky now, perhaps, but you can see the topicality when it came out, how it addressed obsessions, really, people had that today's kids, what's wrong with them, right? You know, and so the film itself, you know, it's sometimes unintentionally funny, but the push come to shove, it's a serious film and works well dramatically. But for our purposes here, just the Poitier is so good in that role. I mean, he's not on screen a whole lot because there are a lot of kids in the classroom, but he holds the screen, as people say about great actors. There's something about the physicality of his presentation. You know, he's photogenic that way, but again, it's that voice as well. There's a commanding presence in him. And so when all the kids are shouting in the classroom, where do your eyes go? Where do your ears go? To him in whatever row he's sitting in, he holds your attention.
Now, this came out the same year as Rebel Without a Cause. And, you know, there was some argument made about that movie that it was the dawn of the teenager, that prior to that movie, that there weren't teenagers, there were children, and then you became immediately considered an adult. And that movies like Rebel Without a Cause kind of made the concept of the American teenager a very real thing. And like you said, trying to open up the market for the youth market, which of course would have been fascinated by things like the rock and roll music and the depictions of what would look like real life to some of the people who would go see the movie.
You're absolutely right about that. One reason why there was an obsession with juvenile delinquency in the 1950s was it truly was the decade when teenagers were invented, if I can put it in a sort of funny way. In other words, prior to that, you're right, you went from being a kid to being an adult, right? There wasn't this obsession culturally with the teenage years, that whole experience. In the 50s, that changes, and it would be a whole show unto itself to talk about the consumer culture, to talk about this sort of prolonged adolescence, if you will. But again, in terms of the cultural context in which films are released, you see it by the mid-1950s, not so much in the early 50s, more in the mid-50s and onward. Movies that are about teenagers and, in terms of the film industry, pitched at, aimed at teenagers. And increasingly, you know, movies had always been made for a general audience, right? Everyone from the kid to the grandparents. But increasingly, think about all the films from the mid to late 50s that are made really for teenagers. I mean, other people might go and enjoy, but they're made about and for teenagers. And it's not coincidental that Rebel Without a Cause comes out in the same year. It's very much about a disaffected youth, right? It's very much about the real angst of being a teenager. You can actually chart that quite literally in terms of the record charts. Think about the music on the airwaves. How much changes in the mid to late 50s, right? You know, with Elvis and the recently deceased Little Richard and so on. These are artists, recording artists, who are really pitching their music at teenagers. And it's not coincidental then that Blackboard Jungle has rock music for the first time on its soundtrack.
I also think that's how you get away with having a slightly older looking Sidney Poitier for the role that he was playing. You know, if you go back and look at old high school yearbook from the time, you know, everybody looked like little adults. You know, they had the same hairstyles and clothing and glasses as their parents. You know, you can't tell, are they 18 or are they 40?
Well, because they really were at that point preparing to enter the job market. And bear in mind that at that point, people tended to marry at a somewhat younger age than they do now, right? So by your late teens, you are thinking about marriage. You're thinking about starting a family of your own. And ironically, and maybe even kind of sadly from our perspective, you're starting to look like your parents, which nowadays you think, oh my goodness, no, I'm looking like my mom or my dad.
But it's never good.
No, never good when you're that age, right? But all joking aside, you can really see that, you know, more movies are being made about and for teenagers. And yet in terms of the social mores of that time, you are preparing to enter the job market, enter the marriage market, if you will. How many of those movies actually do deal with that quite overtly, right? In terms of, you know, getting married, starting a family, the pressure was there to a greater, or the expectation was there, let's put it that way, to a greater extent than it is today. Now you can afford to be a teenager for a little bit longer, I guess. You can ease into adulthood and still be living in your parents' basement when you're in your 20s, right?
Yeah, completely different world. Now, for those who have not seen Blackbird Jungle and are planning to watch it, a couple of things you should be aware of. There are several things in the movie that seems shocking by today's standards. One is the blatant sexual harassment of the one attractive woman who is a teacher. And the other is just the way that they put their hands on these kids, slam them up against blackboards, get really physical in a way that by today's lights looks like straight up assault.
It's almost shocking in that respect now when you realize, you know, the degree to which corporal punishment in the classroom or in the hallway was the societal norm in a lot of ways. In other words, this is something I'll say, you know, very straightforwardly, that the audience going to see this film in 1955 would not have had the discussion you and I are having at this moment. You know what I mean? They would have talked about the social issues in the film and racial concerns, because that's right there in the script. But when it comes to that kind of corporal punishment of, you know, of a teacher slamming a student against the walls, things like that, we watch it now and we're horrified, like, oh my goodness, you know, you'll lose your job, or, you know, mm-hmm. at least get taken to the principal's office or something, right?
Arrested.
I know, exactly, arrested even. But again, how that reflects the period when it was made, the social values and so on, that, you know, discipline, as we mentioned earlier, was not only an important issue in the film, but my goodness, is it directly administered in some of those scenes. And again, when we watch older movies, we're always going through this exercise of what holds up and in various ways. In other words, what do we still approve of? What do we say, well, that's the value that we also hold? And other things we think, oh my goodness, not only don't I believe that, but how could they have done that or believe that? And that's always the case, isn't it? You know, you go back and look at an earlier period, what matches up with our reality today, our social standards, and what it was like then. And it doesn't mean that we approve of that kind of behavior in the earlier films, but simply that it becomes what I always call a discussion point. You know what I mean? It's something to talk about as a class. And as you and I talk about it back and forth in terms of, well, what were the social values? What was the ethos, if you will, of a particular society? And again, it's not a matter of condoning it or giving it a pass, but simply of having it on the table for discussion.
Poitier also talks about filming Blackbird Jungle and says back then that he couldn't go into certain stores and try on a pair of shoes. If he wanted something from a restaurant outside the community in which he was confined, he had to go to a back door. If he rode the bus, he was in the back of the bus. So we forget that aspect of it too, that, you know, in some ways he's playing a role that's sort of beyond the experience of what it was really like to be a Black man in the 50s.
Well, read biographies of Black actors, also for that matter within the world of entertainment, Black jazz musicians, anyone working in show business, if you will, and they may have been big stars on the stage, but you know what? When they got off the stage, went to the dressing room, then went out to the street, they could not be served or were not served in restaurants. They weren't allowed to stay in certain hotels. You know, this is really a shocking history that in some ways, you know, a white audience might actually go to see this person on the screen or on stage, right? And yet would not allow that same person to come into the restaurant or into the hotel, or if so, you know, use the back door, not the front door. And read any biography of actors of that generation and you know, whether stage or screen or of musicians of that generation. And it's a never-ending shock as to the inequity in society, but also the incredible hypocrisy, right? You know, the fact that, you know, well, you know, we'll buy your record or we'll buy a movie ticket, whatever, but no, you can't come in the front door.
I think we saw a little bit of this in Green Book that sort of depicted how that was. So let's fast forward a little bit to the 60s with 1961's A Raisin in the Sun, which I had never seen before. And when I watched it, I was just blown away and thought, this is why he is such a great actor. It's such a powerful role, and it comes right off of the stage, and it feels like it, you know, looks like a filmed play. But he's just absolutely exceptional in it. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I used this film in a course I teach on Hollywood in the 1960s, and I think it's a remarkable ensemble, not just Sidney Poitier, but Claudia McNeil, Ruby Dee, Dinah Sands, even Dixon, Louis Gossett. I mean, it's a great cast. As you pointed out, it's based on the Lorraine Hansberry play, which was a great critical and commercial success on Broadway. This film version, which was released in 1961, ironically didn't do that much business. And the reason it's been postulated is that it is stage bound. In other words, it opens up a little bit, but it's very much a film stage play. Now, for me, I think that's actually the great virtue of it. It's a great play. It's meant to be insular. It's a Black family living in a small apartment, dreaming about moving to a better neighborhood, dreaming about buying a house in a white neighborhood and so on. And it needs to have a certain claustrophobia. You know what I mean? You need to be trapped in that apartment. And the film very astutely only goes outside occasionally. Yeah, somebody goes out on the lawn, somebody gets in a car. I mean, there are a few moments where it lets some air in that way. But I'm actually glad that it doesn't open up more than that. But ironically, that's why the film presumably didn't do better at the box office. People thought it was kind of, you know, stilted, confining, you know, not a movie, right? You know, very much film theater. But what great film theater. Terrific performances right down the line. And I think, you know, for him as an actor, it's absolutely one of his best performances ever. I mean, he's really astounding in it because he plays the son in the family who is so conflicted in terms of what he wants and how to attain it and so on, that the conflicts are just overwhelming. When I used the film the other year in my classroom, there were sniffles. There were people getting choked up watching it. I mean, it has that kind of just powerhouse quality to it, a reminder of not only what a great play it is, but that the film version actually deserves more attention than it sometimes received. I mean, it's not going to be the great cinematic experience. It's not a David Lean movie, you know what I mean? It's not that kind of a movie, but it captures a great play with the original cast, and you really see why A Raisin in the Sun was such a great statement. You know, again, we keep talking about the civil rights movement, but, you know, what it meant to try to go from, you know, a poor neighborhood and struggling and trying to make it. And when you think you can make it and move to a better neighborhood, but what if you're the first Black family moving into a white neighborhood and the neighborhood association, I'll put it that way, does not exactly roll up the welcome wagon. And so again, it's a really tense, it's a really searing film in a lot of ways.
It's interesting how the movie has so many named actors like you mentioned, but the focus I think is on Sidney Poitier's son in the movie, because you're so worried that what happens will destroy this young boy. That's what the audience assumes. But in the third act, you know, he comes out of the ashes, and that's where the real drama is, because Sidney Poitier looks at his son and he talks to him. And in fact, he seems to be talking to the audience through the boy.
One of the great things about the play is that it deals with a relatively small family, and equal attention psychologically is paid to each of those characters. What I'm getting at, you don't feel like there's just one or two characters anchoring it. Each of those characters has his or her moment, and more than a moment, right? To really establish them. Because in a lot of plays, if you have a character like the son, you know, the kid, he's going to be like, you know, the kid running through the room, right? Or, you know, one or two scenes. But no, here, everyone is what I would call a fully rounded character.
You know, I want to briefly mention 1963's Lilies of the Field, because he won an Academy Award for it. But then I want to get right to 1965's A Patch of Blue, which is my favorite Sidney Poitier movie and one of my favorite movies of all time. So before we get to that, Mike, do you have anything specific you want to say about Lilies of the Field?
Yes, I do. In terms of American film history, it's really important. When Sidney Poitier won the Academy Award for Best Actor for Lilies of the Field, it was the first time that a Black actor had won that award. Bear in mind, the only previous Oscar recipient who was a person of color would have been Hattie McDaniel, who won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for Gone with the Wind in 1939. So she was the breakthrough that way to win an Oscar at all. That was for supporting actress. Poitier comes along in 1963 and wins the Academy Award for Best Actor for Lilies of the Field. It's impossible to really say too much about that because it was so significant that a Black actor had won the top acting prize that way. So that's one reason why it's such an important film in terms of American film history. Frankly, though, watching it as a film, it raises questions that will come up periodically in his career. Namely that, you know, in the film, he plays a, you know, basically good guy who helps out some nuns, and he's going to help build a chapel and work around the place and so on. It's really well-intentioned, but it's sort of like the heart on the sleeve kind of thing. And the film keeps flirting with it. It's borderline saccharine. And this is an issue that sometimes comes up in his career. He's playing good guys. The films are incredibly well-intentioned. Are there times where they're a little too simplistic, or I don't want to say patronizing, but just simply that somehow there's a sugar coating sometimes on what can be really harsh issues? And I think in Lilies of the Field, it has that feel-good quality. What's your sense of that? Because again, I think it works well as a film, and certainly his performance deserves the top Academy Award. But watching it, there are places where you realize, yes, it's a film of its time in that sense. It's sending a message of brotherhood and racial harmony and this and that. But maybe sometimes it has a borderline greeting card. Well, is this fair to say, a borderline greeting card quality? What do you think?
I think that's actually a really good way to talk about that movie. But moving on to A Patch of Blue, I found this movie on, I think it was, back in the day when you had to bring in movies with PBS and, fool with rabbit ears and everything. I remember this coming on and just being absolutely riveted by this movie. And then remembering that it had the word blue in it, and then finding it again a couple of years later. And, I would have been, really young at the time. It made a huge impact on me. It's a story of a blind girl who has a very abusive home life. Shelley Winters actually won the Oscar for her performance as her evil mother. And then Sidney Poitier comes along and meets her in the park. And he's simply a guy trying to help a young girl in need. You have to remember that this is the time of the March on Selma, the first Civil Rights Act, and the sit-ins. But he says that, he looks for themes that say something positive and useful about the human condition. And that when he read A Patch of Blue, what attracted him was the attempt to salvage a human life and the depiction of the amount of energy such an effort can take. And I think it's his most powerful movie. He says he still gets mail about it. The life of that girl and the life of this guy are informing people who weren't even born when the film was made. He said he was 39 when that film was released. Now at 72, I don't think a month goes by that I don't hear from 3 or 4 people about that movie.
Here's a question I have for you. It absolutely is one of his best films, and it has a strong following, as you indicated. But for some reason, why do you think it is that it's not even better known than it is? People mention a short list of his films, and it doesn't always make that list.
That's a really good question, because, maybe it's because he's just made so many of them, and that one sort of gets lost in all of the great things there are to talk about with his other movies. We are kind of coming down the home stretch here, so I think we need to blaze through 1967, where he made To Sir With Love, In the Heat of the Night, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
It's one of the most amazing years that any actor has ever had. Think about it. The films you just mentioned all coming out in the same year. I mean, it's just astounding. And these are all strong films. I use In the Heat of the Night in a course I teach, and also use Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. My goodness, what great acting. He's at the height of his career at this point. He'll go from that to making a lot more movies in the early 70s, and significantly as both the star and the director. Films like Buck and the Preacher, A Warm December, Uptown Saturday Night, Let's Do It Again, A Piece of the Action. Not all great movies, but solid commercial films, right? And the fact that he's both star and director, he's segueing a bit. He's behind the camera as much as in front of it.
It's interesting that he made To Sir With Love, where he's the teacher of the difficult students after having been the difficult student in Blackbird Jungle. That's a nice little bookend. I also use In the Heat of the Night in my class with Helen Mitchell, where we teach film and philosophy. And I definitely want to mention the fact that you should watch Guess Who's Coming to Dinner if you've never seen it, if only because he's playing off of Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, but also because I think it's a really good movie to see if you've ever seen Get Out, because there are elements of it that show up that I think are definitely a callback. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing to stress before we sign off from this episode is the fact that part of the great significance of this actor is that he was a crossover movie star. Think about an actor nowadays like Denzel Washington, appeals to both white audiences and black audiences, all audiences, right? If you go to the movies, you love Denzel Washington. Poitier was really that breakthrough generation where he had a strong following among black moviegoers and white moviegoers, that he really appealed across the board that way. And when you think about him in terms of critical reception and commercial appeal, he had a great run in the 1950s and 60s and into the 1970s. He really was one of the major Hollywood movie stars at that point. Hasn't done much in more recent years, but my goodness, what a strong run he had from the 50s well into the 70s.
You know, the New York Times published an article titled, "Why Do White Folks Love Sidney Poitier So?" And the issue boiled down to why he wasn't more angry and confrontational. He says in the same book that I was talking about, The Measure of a Man, that, you know, people called him an Uncle Tom or even a house Negro for playing roles that were non-threatening to white audiences, for playing the noble Negro who fulfills white liberal fantasies. In essence, I was being taken to task, he says, for playing exemplary human beings. The young engineer turned school teacher into Sir with Love, the Philadelphia homicide detective far from home in the heat of the night, and the young doctor who comes courting the daughter of Tracy and Hepburn in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Yeah, the charges against him really are not fair in a lot of ways, and yet they were effective. By the early 1970s, Black activists and younger moviegoers really thought of Poitier as being too much of an accommodationist, and they really felt that, well, that's why white audiences liked him, you know, because he was not threatening that way. And it's a complicated discussion. I think fundamentally it's not a fair allegation against him, but you know what? It was effective. And a younger, a different generation of actors starts to come on the stage, and he does less acting, not coincidentally, I think, but by the end of the 70s.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program. Don't forget to check us out online at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com, and we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.